just to kind of change the name, just change the face and what people thought of it. That's the other reason why we're able to push the rents, because you don't have that presence in those properties anymore. So people can feel it when they go outside. And so they want to tell their friends to live there and they feel safe to be there. So it made a huge difference.
Welcome to Multifamily Deal Lab, where your host, Dave Lindahl, dissects recent multifamily deals done by his guests. Dave will extract what went right, what went wrong, and a number of key takeaways so your next deal may be more profitable.
Welcome everybody to this edition of Multifamily Deal Lab. I've got two gentlemen with me, Mark Schuler and Josh Welch, and they're going to talk about the deal they did, 161 units in Houston, Texas, that had a gang in there. And we'll talk about that a little bit on how they got rid of that gang. So why don't you guys introduce yourselves and tell everybody where you're from?
Sure. Why don't I start? I'm Mark Schuler. Been practicing architecture for about 40 years up in Seattle. Associated with Dave for almost 10 years now.
Long time.
Just been grinding away, doing deals. Kind of a deal junkie. I partnered up with Josh about 8 years ago, and we've done several deals together. Yeah, it's been a good partnership.
Great. So I'm Josh Welch. My company is Three Pillars Capital. We're based out of Houston, Texas. Been around since 2017. Totally acquired about 4,000 units in total. We've sold some since then, but that's our kind of count since we started. Mark's been a huge player and co-GP with us in a lot of those deals. So his expertise really helps us in a lot of different areas, especially when it comes to due diligence and just common sense and just his expertise in that space. But yeah, so we're a value add focused multifamily shop. Don't do that much class A, mostly B and C, repositioning the assets. And yeah, it's been a fun ride so far.
How'd you guys meet up? Decide that you wanted to work together?
That's kind of an interesting story. I live in Puget Sound, where, to put it mildly, government interference in the private market is kind of a sport and knows no limits. The latest intrusion is City of Seattle has now limited late fees to $10. So I have 40 units I own here, and March 7th, this month, 26 out of the 40 units was late. So I got really tired of doing deals up here, and I sold two of the three assets I had and started doing reconnaissance trips down to Houston. One of those trips, I met Josh through a mutual acquaintance who was a broker. Turns out we're both Michigan grads, both went to Michigan engineering. I tucked tail and ran over to architecture halfway through the program and found that was a better fit for me. We think a lot alike and certainly look at the business very similarly. So, you know, it was just a really natural partnership and we started doing deals together. So it was just dumb luck, coincidence, stars aligned, however you want to call it. But we've been, like I said, doing deals for about 8 years now.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this 161 unit deals in Houston, Texas. So that's basically where you guys do business. From what I understand, you don't go into other markets usually. That's your home base and you guys know everything that's going on there. So how did this one come up? How did this 161 unit deal come up?
Well, this was part of a portfolio acquisition that I had known about for 3 or 4 years. And a lot of people tried to take it down is kind of what I heard, but the sellers were a bit of a challenge to say the least. Josh can definitely attest to that.
Mm-hmm.
And managed to get it under contract. And I think all in, how many units was it total, Josh? It was three assets and I don't remember the count.
Right. So I think this is the first of the three. So total units was 688.
Did you have to buy all three?
We didn't have to buy all three. We started out with this one because this was a seller who has been kind of a godfather in the Houston market for years. His family actually built these properties. They were built in the 80s. And we happened to be the second buyer to get it out of his, to wrestle it away from the family because they didn't want to sell. They were these kind of owners that kind of set it and forget it. And then the properties kind of went, the sons and the heirs, and they were just making mailbox money. And that's what we've noticed happens in some of these older assets where it's held in the same family for years and they refinance it. At some point, the loan, the basis and the deal is so low that they're making so much margin on their cash flow that they don't have to do any work. They can just sit back and collect a check. That's great when you've had it for 30 years and you get to do that. But if you're a new buyer operator coming in, you have to force value and you have to force income higher to make up for what you're now paying for that asset. So this was the first of the three that we bought. And then about 6 months later, we bought the other two for a combined total of 688.
So you had made the statement that they didn't want to sell. So who is like leading the sales of this? My understanding, it's a family asset. And then now there's some that don't want to sell. And now there are some that do want to sell. So talk about that story.
I think a lot of it was a dynamic. I think there was three in the family and the one guy was a little bit older than the rest. And he was just kind of ready to retire, like a sail in the sunset. We were in with him. At the time, we had somebody on our team who knew that family really well. He's our acquisitions director with him. And we kind of just got through this guy and said, look, if you really want to retire, we'll buy it from you. We'll give you a great price at the time. And it was an offer that was good enough. It was too good to refuse. And he was able to convince his other two partners or in the family that it was time to let go of it. So, and they did make out pretty well.
Too good to refuse for him, but yet you saw the upside potential I see it's a C property in a B area. Mm-hmm. So certainly there's some upgrading to do. Describe a too good to refuse offer.
Lots of hard money day one. Very fast due diligence. So we're talking 30 days. No financing contingencies. That's just a given. Basically to the point where even if a deal blows up and 60 days has gone by, they still walk away with a decent chunk of cash. And I believe on this deal, I think it was $500,000, if I'm not mistaken. Wow. So they're going to walk out with $500,000 no matter what. Even if due diligence fell apart and has all sorts of issues, they were still going to do all right. And so I think that's really what, and we weren't the first people to go into this neighborhood and try to get these properties. So I think having the really strong hard money offer, just how aggressive we were and how fast we moved, I think speed was key as well. Like we did not hesitate to get the LOI and then go straight to PSA. I mean, we were very quick about the whole thing.
Excellent. Mark, talk about the upgrade. C property, B area, where's the opportunity? What did you do?
Yeah, put it mildly, there's a little bit of deferred maintenance. They had built these in the 80s and then they self-managed forever, basically renting to anybody with a pulse for years. And these type of family-owned assets, I've bought these. I still own one here in town, Seattle. And there's this social contract that gets into place where you pay your rents and don't complain and I'll keep rents low. And so they really didn't do a hell of a lot to kind of maintain the place. So that's one thing. Remember correctly, Josh, the partnership agreement had some crazy, didn't you have to go back and have them rewrite the partnership agreement before we could close because there were like partners who had deceased like years ago and remembering this correctly?
Yeah, there was something to do with some Mexican entity that made it a little sticky. Yeah, we had to get a couple of different signatures and the sign-offs, which again was all on their end, but it could have easily derailed the deal and got the thing held up. So we did have to work through some sticky legal issues, but it wasn't terrible from what I remember.
And then to answer your question directly, Dave, I mean, our standard program is to condo quality finish on the interiors. We're doing granite countertops, tile splashes, granite vanities in the bathrooms, upgraded mirrors and lighting package. We do glass vessel sinks in all the bathrooms. I mean, it's really pretty nice finish level vinyl, luxury vinyl. Kind of the business model is to command market plus 10% on the rents. So we're always trying to achieve our upside case on the rents. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you've never achieved your upside rents on any of the deals we've done.
Yeah, we've never had a situation where we're not able to achieve the upside case. It gives us a lot of margin. I think, you know, what we look for is, not to digress, but, you know, we look for properties where the submarket is commanding a certain market rent. If you have a good product and the rent is here, right? If we find a property where the rent is not there and the product is not at the level of the rest of the market, we find those properties and we figure out what it costs us to do the work to renovate them to our level, which is usually a lot higher than the rest of the market. And then we still only target that top rent in the market. So like at the end of the day, all we're really doing is forcing value into the property. We're not banking on appreciation. So that's really the secret behind the model is that we're not finding the lowest hanging fruit where if you do the work, you'll get paid, right? So we're not waiting for the market to reward us because the market's going up. We're making the market reward us.
Fourth appreciation, valuation. So Mark, did I hear you say that you're looking to get market plus 10% rents?
Something like that. That's our upside case. Yeah. And believe me, our underwriting works at the base case as well. And So all of our deals are like an 8 pref 20 plus IRR. And if we achieve the upside, well, we're just making all that much more for our investors. So, but we always underwrite to the base case. We don't bank on anything. You know, we don't assume that we're going to make the upside case at all.
Right. Well, how much were you putting in per door?
Oh boy, back in that 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I mean, I think we were at 16 to 17 a door. Mm-hmm. Inflation and supply chain problems, that number's gone up since then. But, you know, it's a substantial lift.
Yeah.
Josh can address this more than I can, but his company is vertically integrated as well. Mm-hmm. So all the labor is in-house, all the asset management and all the contracting help is in-house on W-2s. So the expense side of the ledger is under control. That cost for anybody else who's doing third-party contractors and third-party management would easily be twice that.
Yeah.
The equivalent for a different syndicator who's, you know, hiring a contractor to come in is $32,000 to $35,000.
Good point. Good point in terms of the opportunity when you start bringing things in-house, when you start to scale. Because I heard you say, Josh, you had 4,000 units. I remember when we were up around there, we started bringing, that's when we went to our own management company. That's where we started our own make-ready teams that were going from property to property. And the economies of scale just makes everything so much better. So with that type of a lift, how much were you able to push rents per doll? Say $100 per door, $150, $200 per door? Where were you? Lower.
I mean, we're pushing rents and we're actually still increasing the rents today. I want to say like maybe $150 to $200 a door. I mean, the rent increases on that particular project was about 20% across the board.
All right, good. And then let's talk about the raise. How much was the property was 14.2? And did you have to negotiate this property going in? Did you make an offer, or did you make an offer? You said you made an offer you couldn't refuse, or you made it easy to buy, but who set the price?
It was basically, I mean, the way that we operate is we will take, give me a set of financials and a rent roll, and I'll tell you what I can pay for it. I don't care what you think you need for it. I'll tell you what I can afford and what makes money for me. And if it works, great. If not, you know, we'll go on to the next one. So that's how this one happened, is got a set of financials. Some of it was based on sales comps, but most of it was just based on what, how the property was performing at the time. We kind of backed into our sales price from there. Like, we knew we needed to get a 20 IRR and something that was close to a cash on cash annual yield. And so we found the price that he was willing to accept that gave us those numbers.
Did he accept your first offer, or did he counter?
I want to say he accepted it, because I think it was a lot more than we were ever expecting to get. So I think he was like, okay, take the money and run kind of thing. If anything, the counter was in the terms. The price was never negotiated after we gave him an offer.
So they really didn't understand or could see the upside potential of that property.
Yeah. And again, I think thing was held together by Band-Aids decades. They were, again, Band-Aid solutions, didn't have a lot of CapEx dollars. So they, even if they wanted to, they'd have to go out and raise more money to pump back in than bring it up to the level that we did. So you come with a new group like us, we pump millions of dollars into it and we raise the money. You know, we can do that, right? But if you're an operator, you ran out of cash years ago, and you've only, you're just banking on cash flow, it's really hard to want to put the effort to do that, if you catch my drift.
So what was the raise in this property?
I just looked that up. It looked like it was about 7.2.
Yeah.
Did that include the rehab cost? $2.5 million?
Partly. Back then, we were doing bridge to perm quite a bit. So for your listening audience that doesn't know or understand what a bridge loan is, bridge loans will finance, did we go 80% on this one, Josh?
Yeah, I was at 80% loan to cost. That was before COVID, though. I mean, this is lots of change since then.
Yeah.
But more importantly, explain why you used the bridge loan in this particular circumstance.
Because they financed a big chunk of the renovation as well. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to go out and raise. We raised part of that reno cost, but the bridge loan will pay for quite a bit of the renovation. So that's just part of the loan. And then there's this complicated draw process you go through every month as you grind through the renovation, you get reimbursed.
Very complicated, depending on which lender you use. Did you use Fannie Mae's bridge to perm deal?
No, it was a different bank. It was a debt lender out of New York. A lot of times Fannie's, we found that the Fannie stuff doesn't really work for what we do. I mean, it can work for some people. I just think that our speed of how we need to, we try to get the renovations done very quickly. We target about 5% a month so that at the end of 2 years, which is usually aligns with these loan terms, we're done with the work and we can refinance out of it. Just that some of these other debt programs are a lot more flexible. The speed of the draws are a lot faster. So we don't tend to work with Fannie on those.
I've done a Fannie draw loan before, and it was the brain damage I went through to try to get those draws pulled was excruciating. I never want to do another Fannie.
Yeah. The raise, where did you get the raise? Where did you find the money?
Kind of an all hands on deck exercise for us. I mean, we're wrapping one up right now. It's just you do enough of these for a long enough period, you just get quite an investor database put together. Mm-hmm. And back then is more of the beginning of the exercise for us. So like just all hands on deck, go find money. Mm-hmm. And you hit up everybody you can find. I don't recall how long it took us to do this one, but we were able to get it done pretty quickly.
I do know that we had a pretty big seed investor. So we have a couple of family offices that we tap into. They're usually good for half to three quarters of the stack, which then makes it easier to fill in the rest, which I think is key. If you're doing any type of big deal, it's really important to get some big seed investors to think that no matter what, got at least half of it. And that also helps give confidence to other smaller investors. Like, hey, look, I've already got half the stack come in on the equity. There are $1 million plus check writers. You know, I've got it taken care of. It helps give confidence too.
Do you typically do a webinar presentation to the other?
Not really. I mean, every once in a while by request, if there's like a group of guys that like, hey, I want to invest $3 million. Can you do a small presentation? Sure, I'll do that. But we don't do like one big broadcast for the entire database.
We fill our deals so quickly that we've had more than one deal where we were scheduled to do a webinar and the raise got done before we had a chance to do the webinar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tend to bypass that step.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, it is.
So, okay. So we went to the raise. So tell us about the gang. I see in the notes that you wish you knew there was a gang there. So what?
That was in the next door asset, if I'm remembering correctly, Josh. Is that correct?
You talking about the one that we then picked up 6 months later?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where you have mailbox money owner who rents to anybody with a pulse. Josh, I'm going to let you take it from here.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of just going off of what I said before, you have, when it's just that easy and you don't have to do that much effort to make a decent return every month, you kind of just you start letting your operations kind of slow down. You even employ people with a pulse. So some of these managers that they had on site, I mean, they were still, believe it or not, they were still doing leases on typewriters when we took over, which is like unheard of. Like this only time I've ever seen that. These people were paid super low wages, so they didn't care. They were not incentivized. Leasing agents were not being incentivized on new leases. And so they literally were just, hey, as long as I can keep my job, as long as I keep it 95%, I don't care who comes in here. I don't care what your job is. I don't care how much you can pay on the deposit. Just like, hey, give me $50. Okay, come on in. Like, it was bad. So what happened is it just became known as the spot on the street where, okay, gangbangers and thugs could hang out. It was like their central. So we had a little bit of that at this first property. And then those people all got evicted very quickly because once they realized that we were actually coming to kind of swinging the hammer and laying down the law, they left very quickly. And then went to the property next door, which is what we wound up buying 6 months after that. So we had to kick them out again. But you fast forward 2 years, we had to do things like beef up security, do a lot of branding with the property, like a lot of marketing, just to kind of change the name, like just change the face and what people thought of it. It took a while, took a couple of years, but I think it's safe to say we're past that point now, and it's no longer seen as heaven. And leasing is tremendously picked up. I think that's the other reason why we're able to push the rents, because you don't have that presence in those properties anymore. So people can feel it when they go outside. And so they want to tell their friends to live there and they feel safe to be there. So it made a huge difference.
Yeah, it was a good opportunity to be able to pick up that property next door, because if you couldn't, that would have been a big problem through the years, being able to get rid of those people. Mm-hmm. Could that happen to me in Austin, Texas? We get rid of everybody, but they went next door. And then that owner didn't care. And he didn't care to sell either. Like, damn, man, that made that property a difficult one to run.
It's gone on three doors. It's gone far enough where they can't mess with your property, you know?
Did you have to change the names of the properties?
We didn't. In hindsight, maybe we should have, but we didn't. We kind of just stuck through it.
Yeah, I always say when you're doing like a repositioning like that is you've got to change the perception of the property in the neighborhood. And you know you've won when you get somebody to move in and they actually refer to a friend. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, now this thing's starting to turn around, which is good. All right, so what did it cost you for security on that property?
I mean, definitely a lot more spend in the beginning, at least $10,000 to $15,000 a month. And then, of course, after we got a lot of the bad apples out, that we were able to cut that back. And now I think today, a few thousand dollars a month. And that's just weekend patrol and a couple of times a night.
Awesome.
You have to put a security gate across the entrance.
Yeah.
You did? Yeah. On both of them or just one?
Both.
It was just the one next door, right, Josh?
We did. No, both.
Oh, you did do both. All right.
Yeah. We actually sold this. The deal we're talking about today, we already sold it.
Sold this deal that we're talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, what was the return?
This one was a 43% total net return.
What'd you sell it for? So you sold it for 20-something?
It was, Mark, you remember the exact price? I should know this.
I don't. I know it was a good deal.
Oh, yeah,
because when you punch the rents up as fast as we did, Dave, and turn around and sell it real quick. I mean, I think we sold this in a little over 2 years, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was exactly 2 years, almost to the day. It's kind of...
So, you know, the IRR on that, giving the investors their money back that quickly on that, especially that profit on the back end, mm-hmm. The IRR had to be up in 35%, something like that.
I mean, I mean, definitely over 20. Because, I mean, again, our investors got paid really well. And most of that did come at the end.
Right.
So yeah, it's definitely going to be a little bit higher than 20.
Say at least we performed the way we said we were.
Yep. Awesome. It sounds like even better. So I want to ask you guys the most inspirational books you've read, what you're reading now, the most inspirational movie that you've had. And then I'm going to ask you to give out your contact information for anybody that may want to contact you. So how about the first inspirational book, Mark?
Inspirational. And I've read so many, Dave. The one that, you know, I've read a lot regarding the business. I've also read a lot about the Rockefeller habits. I've just read a lot of books about how to...
Choose one. If you're going to recommend one book to somebody, what would it be?
Choose one. Of course, there's the Lindahl books. Those are always great.
Yeah, those are the greatest. We're just looking for the next year down.
Now, probably the Rockefeller habits. I've read that book probably... I don't know how many times.
Wow.
And I always get a new nugget out of that. It's a classic. But, you know, there's wisdom imparted in that book. I think I'd take 10 of these other books off the shelf and you just read that and just read it once a year. You learn something new every time.
Excellent. Josh, how about you? Most inspirational book?
I would say memory is going to kill me here. The one that I can remember that's the most inspirational is going to be Attraction by Gino Wickman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Once I understood how people kind of come together in tribes and everything's about accountability and building each other up and everything's teamwork based.
Did you use that as an operating system or do you use it now as an operating system?
We are, yeah. Yeah, we just implemented it this year. So yeah, it's hugely impactful.
Did you do it yourselves or did you use an implementer? Hire an implementer too?
No, I mean, we talked about it, but we just hired, he's now the CEO of the management company, but he came in with a lot of background in implementing that system already. So he brought his expertise and brought it into our team.
Excellent. Mark, what are you reading now?
A lot of financial reports. Candidly, I don't have time to read right now. I've got so much going on that I just can't take the time to, you know, sit down and read a book. And that's
okay.
I'm trying to kind of take care of a deal in Mississippi.
No problem. Josh, what are you reading now?
I'm reading right now. I'm actually listen. I like audiobooks. So my audiobook right now is called The 4-Hour Body by this guy named
Tim Ferriss.
Yeah. Tim Ferriss. It's basically like, how do you find these life hacks to like lose a bunch of weight, but in a healthy way. And
yeah.
Understand how your body can like burn fat, not carbs, but like what's the science behind it. So
mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting. It's a good book. Okay. Movie. Most inspirational movie, Mark?
Oh boy. Well, my dad was aviator in World War II.
Yep.
The older I've gotten, the more I appreciated Greatest Generation. I find those types of movies really inspirational. Saving Private Ryan, I've probably watched 8 times.
Have you seen Unbroken?
Yeah. No.
It's an awesome movie about a POW that just wouldn't give any information and they just broke, tried to break him and they couldn't. It's a true story. It's a book and it's a true story. It's just awesome.
I'm always fascinated by that. You know, I'm from Detroit and so grit has a big meaning to me because that's just kind of how that city works and operates. And you can't quit. You just can't quit. And so many people in life quit. And it just is mind-boggling. You just got to be the last guy standing and you'll be successful. Kind of been my mantra throughout my life. I mean, you understand part of that 10 Paths book, and I talked about that a lot in that interview, is like you just can't quit. And so growing up in that environment, I'm definitely from a blue-collar working-class background. You know, everybody in my family worked the line. One of my uncles got out of the factory grind and became a brick mason. You know, I wanted something more out of life. I didn't want to kind of work with my hands. I'm not built to be a laborer. So I just kind of like dug deep and propelled myself forward. And it's all self-determination. I'm a big proponent of that. So
awesome. Josh, movie. You have plenty of time to think about it now.
Yeah. Well, I've only actually seen it once, but if we're talking about super inspirational, The Pursuit of Happiness, that is a phenomenal Will Smith movie.
Yep.
You want to talk about a guy who doesn't quit, who made a lot of mistakes and then somehow found a way to strive through it, man. That is a tearjerker and an inspirational movie.
And a true story.
Yeah.
All right. Listen, guys, give out your contact information if anybody wants to contact you.
Mark?
Yeah. I can. You can hit me up at sgreinvestments.com. And it's just mark@sgreinvestments.
Yeah. All right. And Josh?
So Three Pillars Capital, that's tpcgcap.com. Yeah. And I'm josh@tpcgcap.com.
Awesome. This has been another edition of Multifamily Deal Lab. All right, guys. That was awesome. Get a lot of good information. A lot of really good information.
Yeah. By the way, I don't want to say anything, but it was actually 168 units, not 161.
Oh, really? Oh, that's what I have in my notes.
I should have proofread it.
You could correct me.
That's all right. Nobody's going to know.
The people watching do. All right, Jermaine, let's open it up. You got some questions?
I do, Dave. I got some questions. But First of all, great movies. Pursuit of Happiness. Pursuit of Happiness is one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. So inspirational. Actually made me tear up. And I'm not a tear up guy. So, all right. So this one's
from Ron. Wait a minute, Jermaine. Let's talk about that day you gave up cheeseburgers and fries.
I didn't tear up for that. I needed to do that.
All right.
So this one's from Ryan. Ryan writes, since Mark and Josh have been working together for 8 years, what makes or what characteristics make up a good partnership?
Boy, if you can figure that out and bottle it, you'll make a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in some great partnerships and I've been in some miserable partnerships and some partnerships in between. It's a certain synergy that you look for. And it's kind of like dating. It's like you can check all the boxes and there's just no chemistry and it just doesn't work out. And so I think for me, it's you kind of grind through the boxes real quick and just want to figure out if you're aligned, you're pulling in the same direction, if you want to accomplish the same goals, if you like your worldview meshes. I mean, Josh and I are both Michiganders. both Midwesterners, it helps a lot, I think. Both engineers, gearheads, you know. So it's difficult to put your finger on it, but when it works, it's everything. I feel like Josh and I just kind of sync up on a lot of stuff. Is it perfect? No, not always. I'm kind of a pain in the ass at times. I don't know. Josh, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think partnerships are definitely a fun topic. You definitely got to be equally yoked. Like if you have somebody that is just like long-term and short-term objectives, right? You can be aligned with somebody for short-term, 6 months, a year, but then like what happens if somebody's only looking at doing, hey, I just want to make a couple hundred grand and I'm done, right? I mean,
right.
This is somebody's like, I want to build something like a legacy for my family. You're going to run into problems a couple years later, right? So I think having the vision and the alignment on the long-term and short-term goal is huge, right? Not to mention personalities and all that. So
yeah. I think alignment of interests and respect and staying in your lane and not overstepping your boundaries has a lot to do with it. I try to be very, very respectful of Josh's enterprise and not abuse anything. I'm just wired to do that. I'm also a service professional. I have been for 40 years. So I've learned how to communicate with people. That's a big part of it. It's just a lot of communication.
Awesome. Next question, Jermaine.
All right. This one's from Jackie. She wants to know, I'm assuming it's a she, how much hard money did you borrow and what was the rate?
First of all, before I wouldn't consider that hard money. That's bridge financing. That's typical financing in multifamily properties when either you get a construction, pay for some construction, or your deal isn't at equilibrium, 85% occupancy. So that's pretty typical. You want to describe the terms of the bridge?
Yeah. So at the time, I think that was 80% loan to cost. So we were basically getting 80%, roughly 80% of the purchase price and then 100% of the CapEx dollars. So, and the whole idea that we did that again is to finance the renovation dollars because it's a lot cheaper for the deal versus raising it via equity. But again, like if you're doing a deal right now, don't try to go get those terms because they don't exist anymore.
Do you remember rate terms and points from that particular deal or deal you might have done in that same time frame?
That one would have been LIBOR plus 350, I'm going to say. So at the time, LIBOR was like half a point or a quarter point. So it would have been a 4% loan roughly.
Now, how many points did they charge you? Did they charge you points at the closing as an exit fee as well?
There was 1% origination fee. Don't remember the exit fee, but it was probably somewhere around a point as well, a point to exit.
Yeah, I'm looking at the rate terms that we had in there, Josh. I mean, holy smokes. Our assumption for rent, the refi rate, just you just don't see this anymore. We were assuming 3.2% underwriting and 5% going in. I mean, you're just not going to see that anymore.
Mm-hmm. So. And what was your term? How many months did they give you that loan for before it expired?
That was, again, going off memory, 36 months, so 3 years, plus 2-year, 1-year options to extend.
By the way, that is the opportunity in the market today. All of these bridge, what I just mentioned about having to spend money for construction and or you have a deal that's below 85% occupancies, that's the normal use for bridge loans. But in this anomaly that happened for a good 8 or 9 months, bridge financing actually became cheaper than conventional financing. And a lot of people jumped into it to fund their deals, to get their deals to pencil out. Well, now they're coming due and they're coming due at these rates here at 5.5-6%, and they don't pencil out anymore. They're right. Either going to have to give up all their equity, which Mark, you just get a sweet deal, or you both just got a sweet deal because of that. This is the opportunity. The deal that Mark and Josh just did is the opportunity that we're going to be seeing over the next couple of years just pop up, pop up, pop up. Can you explain that one really quick?
And why don't you take that, Josh?
Yeah. So we have a deal in Houston right now. It's 425 units and it's in a part of town that's kind of like the Beverly Hills of Houston, I like to call it, very posh area. And it's a property that it was purchased by the current owners about 4 years ago. And at the time, rates had not yet spiked. So they probably got in around 3-3.5%, something like that, maybe even 4%. They're at a position now where they have kind of failed their business plan to grow the rents. So their NOI has kind of been stagnant. They've had some management issues. And so they're coming up to the point where their loan is now coming due in June. So they have really one of two choices. One is to put cash into the deal, inject more cash to either get out of the loan or extend it, which right now they're looking at having to refinance into a loan that's the rate's twice as high. So they're going to have to put cash in to get out of their current loan or to sell it at a loss. And so they don't have the cash. So they're basically forced to sell it at a loss. And so we're picking up a really great property with really great dirt at about a 15% discount from where they bought it in 2019. So we have not seen that kind of activity in anywhere in almost a decade. So the fact that it kind of sucks that interest rates have been spiking as much as they have been, but it's good in a way because it's kind of resetting the dial. A lot of stuff got very inflated cooling things off a bit. It's necessary in any market, any asset class. You need some type of a cooling off. So it's a great opportunity, though. They're not going to, I think, like Dave said, I think we've got maybe 6 months to 9 months of a window here. And after that, I think it's going to kind of start going back up again.
Yeah.
I mean, what you saw in the last 2 to 3 years, Dave, was a lot of people get into the syndication game.
Yeah.
Didn't have any experience. And we've seen it in Houston.
Oh, man. Those deals that people are putting together and sending over here is like, you want to sponsor this deal? It's like, no.
I mean, we know across from one of our assets down in Southeast Houston, a pretty troubled asset across the street bought by this one syndicator, and he bought a bunch of properties in 2 years in Houston. And I think he's going to lose the ball, isn't he, Josh?
Oh, yeah. He's in trouble. I don't want to name any names right now, but yeah, he's definitely, it's not pretty.
He's just one of many.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. That's all thanks to Russell Brunson. If you're not familiar with his program, Russell Brunson's a marketer and he teaches people how to become a guru.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, we saw this blow up of people come into the multifamily space. I can be a multifamily guru. And people that don't know, they don't know who to follow, you know, and they follow blindly. They follow with trust. If somebody's good at getting trust, then and nobody's trying to lead somebody astray. But learning from somebody that doesn't have the experience, you know, that's where not knowing what you don't know and trying to teach it, it creates difficult times.
Now, there are a lot of people selling hopes and dreams out there in this industry. And I've always had a huge problem with it ethically. And I've always just kind of pulled the Heisman on it because I just don't want anything to do with it. I just want to keep my head down, stay in my lane, do my business model. But too many people, you know, they want to get in. The perception is you can make a lot of money really quick. The reality is something totally different.
A lot of people focused on that front-end acquisition fee.
That's right.
That's what it's all about for some people, getting that big check. All right, Jermaine, next question.
All right, this one is from Jordan. He wants to know, with rent so high now, are you ever nervous about not being able to get your target rents when you buy a property?
The beauty of our model is it's forced appreciation. So when you take a C-minus asset, C-minus units, and turn them into a B, they naturally command a higher rental rate in the marketplace?
Let me ask that question a different way.
All right.
So with the current market conditions where 80% of the country is seeing a rent loss in terms of growth over the next year or so, where are you getting the information to adjust what your projected rents are? Because the trouble that a lot of people are going to get into is they projected their rents are going to increase like so much. They have a pref out there, and when they can't do the pref, it accumulates to the back end, and all of a sudden the back end's not there because they couldn't get their rent increases. So what are you doing to adjust to make sure that the rent increases that you project will actually happen through your forced appreciation?
Josh, why don't I take plan, then I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah. I get the hard.
So there's a lot implicit in what you just asked, Dave. So there really are two types of business models for multifamily. There's the forced appreciation, which is what we do. And then there's the rising tide raises all ships model. We don't do that. We don't wait for the market to move north and push our rents north organically without doing any work. You have to do work. The only way to make money in multifamily right now is value add. From what I can tell, I just don't see anything else working. So if you are renovating these units and putting a fresh product out in the marketplace, the other thing you need to consider is this country is at a critical shortage of housing. You can drop a pin anywhere in this country and we'll find that there is not enough housing for all the people that are demanding it. So there's a lot of upward pressure on pricing. You combine that upward pressure with the forced appreciation model and it sort of works. Josh, I mean, you're there. Why don't you take it from here?
I don't know if I can beat that, Mark. That's pretty well said. I'm kind of hammering on one point. I think, you know, when we pick our rent targets, it's always what are they achieving already today? Highest rent in their floor plan. And then is there support in the market to push that up more? But what usually winds up happening is the highest rent in the rent roll becomes our target. And then what's being achieved in the market becomes our upside case. So that worst case scenario, we always underwrite our deals this way when we pitch a deal. Our 20 IRRs or those high teen IRRs are always based on the base case. So no matter what, if we can just optimize what they're currently doing and just move the needle a little bit, we'll be able to get the returns and the cash flow. But on the flip side, if I can actually hit where the market is and there's very little softening, then these deals become 25 plus, even 30 IRRs. So I guess all that to say is like, if you set your bar pretty low and the deal still works, then there's a lot of room for grace.
Right.
Failure if the market does soften. So that's what I would say to that.
Josh, next question. How many get in the queue, by the way?
There's like five, one, two, three, four, five, six.
All right, six. Yeah. Let's stop it there and let's bang them out.
Okay.
Bang them out. I got to take my wife downtown, so we got to hurry.
Yeah.
All right. This one's from Sarah. She said, I heard that Houston is difficult to buy because of zoning. Is that the case or has it changed?
Well, there is no zoning.
Yeah. Let me answer that real quick. There's no zoning. So you just have to know the area. You have to have somebody in here that knows Houston in order to buy here. Next question.
Yeah. This is for Josh and Mark. Is Houston the only market you guys are in? And if not, what other markets do you favor? This is from Jacob.
Houston, Dallas, basically Texas. We're very pro-Texas. And right now we do have some properties around the Dallas area, Oklahoma. For right now, we're finding the most success kind of in those markets. So we're going to be staying there for a while.
All right, good. Next question. And on a side note, Mark, the person that I'm going to talk to is traveling, and I'll probably get a hold of him early next week.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jermaine.
This one's from Victor. He wants to know how many people moved out of the apartments once you got rid of the gangs?
Oh, how many people moved out or stayed? I'm going to assume you said how many people moved out. So
yeah.
I would say we lost probably a good 30%.
Wow, 30%? I'm surprised. I thought it would be a lot more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you start cleaning up, I mean, birds of a feather flock together, right? So yeah. You kick out the gang, there's a lot of people that are going to go with that.
Right.
Let's say 30%. But naturally, over 2 years, we probably turned over almost probably 80% because the people that were there that maybe some of them couldn't afford the slightly higher rent.
That's what I was thinking. All right. Next question.
All right.
Mark, do you have to go? You can go.
I am getting the hook.
Okay. Go ahead. So we appreciate you being on. And there's only a couple more questions Josh and I can answer them. Josh, you have to go because I can't answer questions too.
I'm good.
All right, one more. Then we'll do one more. This is for both of you guys.
Mark's going to go. Go ahead, Mark.
There you go. This is for Josh and David.
Yeah.
Carlos wants to know, what's the best deal that you've ever done and what's the worst deal that you guys have ever done?
For me, I know my worst deal, but it was that 400 unit that I bought in Huntsville right early on. And it was 46% occupied. And I thought I could take it on.
Mm.
But I was too inexperienced way back then. And it just cost me 6 years of my life and I made no money. So that sucked. But I learned a lot. The best deals, of course, are the ones that turn around quickly and you make a bunch of money. So that's my answer to that one.
Yeah.
Josh?
I'd say best deal for me is the one actually we were talking about today. That was probably one of the best returns. It was the things went according to plan, probably like clockwork the most in this particular deal. Yes, the gang cleanup part was a bit of a pain, but it wasn't as bad as the other two that we already cleaned up. So that was the best one. I'd say the worst one was probably our second deal. It was a smaller 25 unit deal, tons of deferred maintenance. I think we way underestimated. I think we got lured into the deal because we had just done a deal of similar size. We're like, oh, we can handle this one too. Great entry price. But I think we got kind of duped by how cheap it was for how expensive it was going to cost us to actually get the property in a state that was leasable to get our target rents. We wound up making it work, sold it in about 2.5 years, but we didn't make a ton out of it either. So that was a deferred maintenance lesson for sure.
Awesome. Josh, next one.
That's it, Dave.
Oh, that was it? I thought there was the three more.
Yeah, but one of them was for Mark, so, and he's gone. So.
Oh, well, ask it and maybe Josh can answer it.
It was Mark. What's your favorite Dave book?
Oh,
I can't answer. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. So it's probably the one he's in, 10 Pass. So if anybody hasn't read 10 Pass, 10 Pass is actually a bonus that you get for joining the system. But we'll be happy to send you, if you're watching, if you don't have a copy of what's called 10 Pass, it's 10 interviews with 10 different people and how they changed their lives, getting into multifamily, did really, really well. We'll be happy to send you out the PDF. So just email Jermaine at jevans@rementor.com. And you can hear Mark's whole, you can listen to Mark's whole story in there. Oh, why should listen, watch it. Josh, it was awesome. It was a great interview. I really appreciate it. It was nice meeting you or seeing you again since you were at Ultimate Partnering 217.
Yeah, long time. It's been a long time. Well, thanks for having me, Dave. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and good luck out there.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, take care.
This has been another edition of Multifamily Deal Lab. If watching on YouTube, please be sure to hit the like button, the subscribe button, so you don't miss the next session, and review the contact links on this page.